Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative, and United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. Some Democrats say they're disappointed that Albany lawmakers took no action this year to protect immigrants. The New York Public News Network's Jimmy Vielkind reports.
After their sixth rally at the New York State Capitol, immigrant rights activists upped the ante. About a dozen people marched into the street and sat down, blocking traffic. They support a bill called the New York for All Act. It would create a sanctuary state by restricting how local law enforcement cooperates with ICE. Assemblymember Marcella Mitainis was hoping the action would get the bill on the floor.
But there seems to be some the lack of political courage.
Instead, lawmakers left in the middle of June without action on any immigration bills.
We out.
State Senator Andrew Granardis is a Brooklyn Democrat who sponsors New York for All. He says the Trump administration's relentless approach to immigration gave his colleagues pause. That includes President Trump calling out the National Guard after ICE protests in Los Angeles.
This paralysis is the best way I can describe it, where overwhelmingly people want to do something, but what that something is against the backdrop of federal troops being deployed to California.
Governor Hochul also never engaged. The Democrat tries to walk a fine line on immigration. She talks about her Irish ancestors and New York's tradition of welcoming newcomers. During a recent congressional hearing, Hochul refused to say if she supports the New York for All Act.
The state of New York cooperates.
Republicans keep pressing the issue. GOP Assemblymember Jarrett Gandolfo opposes the New York for All Act. He says Hochul is in a bind.
She would have to either veto that bill and really anger her progressive base or sign it, and I think that would turn off a lot of middle-of-the-road voters. Maybe.
Hochul is up for re-election next year. In Albany, I'm Jimmy Vielkind for the New York Public News Network.
New York Governor Kathy Hochul says the state is looking to build a new nuclear power plant, the first nationwide in more than 15 years. Hochul wants it to be located upstate, and some lawmakers are hoping it'll be in their district. Jung Yoon Han from the New York Public News Network has more.
There's already a race between upstate lawmakers to make sure that the plant ends up in their backyard. Leaders in Rochester, the Capital Region, and the Greater Buffalo area have already expressed interest. Assembly Minority Leader Will Barkley, a Republican, represents Oswego County. There are several nuclear power plants in the Greater Oswego area.
Clearly, we've demonstrated in Oswego County that the support is there, and I think there's strong support to, you know, increase our nuclear fleet.
Some lawmakers, however, say they need more answers from the governor about where nuclear waste will be stored and how much the plant will cost to ratepayers. In Syracuse, I'm Jung Yoon Han for the New York Public News Network.
Governor Kathy Hochul was recently in the Adirondacks to warn against the potential impacts of President Donald Trump's landmark legislation. His so-called Big Beautiful Bill would slash funding for Medicaid, food assistance, and other programs that many in upstate New York rely on. It would also add more than $3 trillion to the national debt. North Country Public Radio's Emily Russell with more.
Hundreds of people packed inside the Harrietstown Town Hall. An MC introduced about a dozen of the area's movers and shakers, from leaders of local nonprofits to business CEOs and top political donors.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, please stand and welcome the 57th governor of the great state of New York, Governor Kathy Hochul.
Hochul stood at the podium between two big poster boards. One highlighted the impacts of Canadian tariffs on the region. The other listed potential impacts of Trump's proposed budget cuts. The North Country voted heavily in favor of Trump. This is a pretty solidly red district. But Saranac Lake leans left. Among a more sympathetic crowd, the Democratic governor struck a serious tone.
Because right now, this area is under siege.
The trade war began this spring after Trump imposed steep tariffs on Canadian goods and suggested the country become the 51st state. The president's policies and rhetoric have had a ripple effect throughout the North Country. Border crossings from Canada are down by 20 to 30%. Hochul said that businesses are feeling the pain.
the Malone Golf Club alone, they said they've lost $400,000 in Canadian tourism dollars that they used to count on. I don't know how you pay the bills. I don't know how you pay your staff, how you keep the lights on.
Another focus was Trump's immigration policies. He's pushed for ICE agents to arrest 3,000 people per day. Some of those arrests are happening here on North Country Farms. Michael Murphy, manager of Child Stock Farms in Franklin County, spoke at Friday's event about the impact of Trump's immigration tactics.
One day, mass deportations are promised. The next day, there's a talk of exemptions for farm workers. And then it's back to raids and removals. This uncertainty creates fear and instability in the workforce we all depend on. Immigrant workers are the backbone of New York's agricultural economy. They are highly...
The North Country's healthcare sector is also facing fear and uncertainty. Trump's so-called Big Beautiful Bill would cut Medicaid by nearly $800 million. About 30% of people in the North Country are enrolled in the healthcare program. Dr. Bill Borges is a family physician and chief medical officer of Hudson Headwaters Health Network, which specifically serves lower-income areas in the North Country.
Medicaid cuts, as currently proposed, will impact us directly, very much in the negative, on the order of millions of dollars. By our estimates, we anticipate losing roughly $2.3 million as an organization with those cuts alone.
Republican Congresswoman Elise Stefanik, who represents this area, said she was proud to vote for the so-called Big Beautiful Bill. She said changes to Medicaid would, quote, strengthen and secure the program. Trump's budget would also cut funding for SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. Nicole Lauren is the CEO of the Joint Council for Economic Opportunity, a food pantry that serves Franklin and Clinton counties. Lauren told the crowd on Friday that the number of people JCEO has helped tripled in the last 3 years.
If funding for these critical programs is reduced or even eliminated, people in our community, so these could be your friends, your neighbors, your coworkers, even your family, will face dire consequences.
After a handful of speakers highlighted the impacts of possible funding cuts, Governor Hochul returned to the front of the room. She called on the crowd to push back on the president's proposed budget cuts and urged them to reach out to Stefanik.
You have an influential member of Congress who can do the right thing tomorrow, right? We can allow, listen, I'm going to give everybody, I have hope.
Friday's event came the same day that The Hill, a national newspaper, cited two sources who said Stefanik is preparing to officially announce her run for governor. I asked Hochul about this after Friday's event.
Any Republican who runs, we don't know who that's going to be, will have to do a lot of explaining on why they were the enablers. They were the enablers to Donald Trump's policies when they had the power to stop it.
Trump made real gains in New York in last year's election, getting 44% of the vote compared to 36% in his first election. It was a far closer race for Hochul, who beat her Republican challenger by just 6%. The latest polling shows that Stefanik or another Republican could close that gap even more. In Saranac Lake, I'm Emily Russell for the New York Public News Network.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. This week, I sat down with Don Levy, director of the Siena College poll, to talk about the latest numbers surrounding New York Governor Kathy Hochul.
Well, Kathy Hochul, at this point in time, she just can't win over a majority of New Yorkers. Her favorability ranking, you know, do you have a favorable or unfavorable view of her, sits at 42 favorable, 47 unfavorable, changed just a couple of points from last month. But she's never been able to cross 50% in the percent of New Yorkers who view her favorably. She does a little bit better when we say, well, what do you approve or disapprove of the job she's doing? So moving a little bit from her personal charisma, perhaps, to her nuts and bolts doing the job, Here she's at right at that 50% number. 50%, half of New Yorkers approve, 45% disapprove. She's been hovering there for a bit, and that's up from where she was a little over a year ago when she was only garnering about 39, 40% job approval. But the number that probably is somewhat troubling for the governor, and it's a high bar, we ask what we call the generic reelect question. Looking ahead to the next gubernatorial election, would you vote for Kathy Hochul or would you vote for someone else? And there, when we don't name someone else, Governor Hochul only gets the support of 37%. And this mythical someone else candidate gets the support of 55%. So there is this underlying sense of we'd like somebody else to come in and do a little bit better job. Right now, 50% of New Yorkers feel as though the state's headed in the wrong direction. There's concerns, continuing concerns about affordability in general, housing affordability specifically, dramatic concerns really hovering about health care, Medicaid, the effects perhaps that this big, beautiful bill may have on the SNAP program, and of course continuing concerns over the role that ICE is playing in deporting migrants in our state. So there's a lot of issues that New Yorkers are concerned about. And at this point, when we say, how about someone else, excuse me, someone else beats Kathy Hochul by 18 points. But that, as I'm sure you're going to ask, is where the story only begins.
It certainly is. Boy, was I jumping to get in there. Don Levy of the Siena poll. It is so true. And, you know, more people want someone else to be governor, but not when it comes to a declared Democratic candidate, her own lieutenant governor, Antonio Delgado. Wow, was that something to watch when that came out? And I see in your poll, she's crushing him 49% to 12%. So they don't want the lieutenant governor.
Well, you know, here's a quiz question for you. Name the last five or six lieutenant governors in the state of New York. Antonio Delgado remains relatively unknown to New Yorkers. 58% say they don't have either a favorable or unfavorable opinion of him. So he's got a long way to go just to be known. Similarly, Representative...
And yet, Don, he was a congressman.
He was a congressman, but across the state, whether it be Long Island, whether it be upstate New York City, he remains virtually unknown. Richie Torres doesn't do any better. 60% of New Yorkers don't have an opinion about Representative Torres. And when we do a three-way primary, as may very well occur next June, Kathy Hochul versus Antonio Delgado versus Richie Torres, Kathy Hochul wins huge. She's up 37 points over Delgado, 39 points over Torres. She's sitting right now amongst just Democrats right at 49%. She's way ahead. Now, we just saw a primary in New York City, so you never say never. But right now, given the hill that lies ahead to climb for Delgado and Torres, and of course, there's a hill that Kathy Hochul could fall down, but right now she's way ahead in a Democratic primary.
That's Siena College pollster Don Levy. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. As the New York State legislative session came to a close last week, state lawmakers voted to repeal a decades-old policy referred to as the 100-foot rule. The law allows utility companies to charge customers fees to subsidize the cost of extending gas lines to new users. Republicans opposed to the bill claim the repeal would increase costs for homeowners who would have to foot the bill themselves to get connected. Advocates say the change will save utility customers statewide $200 million per year. The bill was included as part of the larger New York HEAT Act, which aims to decarbonize the state's energy grid. The bill now heads to Democratic Governor Kathy Hochul, who has not signaled whether she will sign it. To learn about what a repeal could mean to New Yorkers, the Legislative Gazette's Samantha Simmons spoke with Christopher Casey, Utility Regulatory Director of New York for the Natural Resources Defense Council. He calls the repeal overdue.
The change will start saving gas ratepayers money immediately, because right now existing gas customers are shelling out approximately $200 million a year to subsidize the build out of the system to reach new customers. So when new customers want to connect to the system, they get to do so for free, and they're subsidized by everybody else. And so this is going to end that practice. And now if you want to attach to the utility gas system, you're going to have to pay those costs yourself. And you're not going to be subsidized by the existing customer base, which is something that just raises costs for everybody and makes gas rates less affordable.
Is there potential for utility companies to, I guess, take this out in some other way on renewable energy users? Could they hike their costs? Are they going to hike costs just in general to cover this subsidy that's now gone or could be gone?
No. The cost of gas utility infrastructure is paid for by gas customers. And so when gas customers, subsidize the build out of the system, you're just raising gas prices for everybody to, basically provide this free build out of the system to a building that is trying to connect to the system for the first time. And today, if you're building a new building, it is cost effective to build that building all electric, so that you do not need to rely for decades to come on polluting fossil fuels.
And the assembly stalled again on the New York HEAT Act, which would ensure clean energy transitions are affordable and reliable for middle class families. This repeal is kind of part of that, but not entirely. The repeal is something you say that is a step in the right direction. But where do we go from here for the rest of those bills in the act?
Yeah, so the 100-foot rule was part of the NY HEAT Act. So it was kind of one of the changes to the law to address how the existing law is kind of subsidizing and promoting fossil fuel use. So repealing the 100-foot rule was a very positive step. It's something that is going to benefit gas ratepayers across the country, across the state, but it is the real opportunity to create a more affordable, equitable, and orderly transition requires some of the broader reforms in NY HEAT. And in particular, it's what's needed is a reform to what's called the obligation to serve, which basically creates a legal entitlement to gas service. And it makes it so it's basically impossible to, start to contract and downsize the gas system in a strategic way without getting the consent from every single customer. And so even there are plenty of cases where rather than digging up the street and putting in highly expensive new pipe that's supposed to last for 100 years, it would actually be cheaper to electrify the buildings that are served by that segment of pipe and then shut down that pipe. And in a lot of instances, you can completely You can electrify all those buildings at no cost to the building owners. You're just purchasing them the electric equipment they need to transition using the less than the money you would have paid to dig up the streets and replace all that pipe. This is a way to kind of, fund the transition of buildings, to buy those buildings clean energy, equipment, new HVAC systems or heat pumps or heat pump water heaters, and to save existing gas payers money because electrifying is cheaper than building out the new infrastructure. Those are some of the broader reforms in NY Heat that are really needed to unlock greater savings, greater benefits, and more affordable energy rates going forward for utility customers across the state.
That's Christopher Casey, Utility Regulatory Director of New York for the Natural Resources Defense Council, speaking with the Legislative Gazette's Samantha Simmons. The New York State Department of Public Service says it doesn't comment on the legislation. Utility National Grid tells the Legislative Gazette it's committed to delivering safe and reliable energy that will help the state reach its decarbonization goals. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. You may want to think twice before you light that campfire this summer. A growing initiative by Bard College to track air quality in the Hudson Valley finds wood burning continues to be the biggest source of air pollution in and around Kingston. The Legislative Gazette's Jesse King has more.
For the past 5 years, Bard's Community Sciences Lab has been monitoring Kingston's air from the top of the Andy Murphy Neighborhood Center on Broadway. Its latest report finds wood burning to be the largest source of fine particulate matter, or PM2.5, in Ulster County. PM2.5 can enter the bloodstream and create or worsen health issues. Here's Bard professor and lab director Eli Duker.
Wood burning in general, it's campfires, it's in your fireplace, it's even in the most efficient pellet stove that you could find. The wood smoke itself creates the most toxic PM2.5 pollution that we have in the Hudson Valley. It is the most toxic to human health, and it also, wood burning creates a direct influence on the rate of climate change in our area.
The report says PM2.5 levels were higher in the winter and summer months, with peaks around the 4th of July. Duker notes no level of exposure to PM2.5 is safe. The Kingston Air Quality Initiative started as a way to give local officials baseline data in the city, but it's now part of a broader effort by Bard to ramp up air monitoring in the Hudson Valley, called the Hudson Valley Community Air Network. A separate study by Pennsylvania State University recently labeled parts of the Hudson Valley as, quote, air quality monitoring deserts, having to rely on distant data from cities that may not reflect local conditions. To combat that, Bard scientists recently placed sensors in Red Hook, Poughkeepsie, and Newburgh as well. Duker says residents can now access real-time air quality data and alerts via the website Just Air.
It can really help communities understand why they might have asthma issues or why it's hazy on a day, right? And so it can help them, and they can look back at the data and actually be able to see it in action.
Once these sites collect enough data, Duker says they'll compile regular air quality reports for these communities as well. In Kingston, lab manager Desiree Lyle says air quality tends to be worse at the ground level than it is higher up. Lyle says this is often the case in cities, as PM2.5 and other pollutants move more slowly around buildings. But because the Hudson Valley is a river valley, Lyle says you also have to account for atmospheric inversion, periods of time when the upper atmosphere is warmer than the air at ground level, trapping pollution underneath.
Whatever pollution is in the air, it's just going to be concentrated on the ground for longer than normal.
The report finds daily PM2.5 levels on Kingston streets exceeded the World Health Organization standards for 20% of 2024. Other polluting factors that aren't always in our control include wildfires, both nearby and distant. Last fall, firefighters responded to several wildfires around the Northeast, including in Ulster County, but Duker says overall air pollution in 2024 was less than the year before.
And I think that has to do with the fact that last year we did not have as horrendous a time with Canadian wildfire smoke as we did the year before.
Still, Duker says their data so far demonstrates that a lot of Kingston's air pollution comes from the local community, and therefore the community can do something about it. If you're wondering how air pollution is addressed, Duker says the answer is mainly time, wind, and rain. But he says we all have a role to play in limiting air pollution in the first place, whether that's biking to the office, switching to sustainable energy sources, or refraining from wood burning, or grilling, or lighting fireworks when pollution is already high.
I really love camping, and it was a tough moment to have to face the science, which is very clear and has been very clear for years, that wood burning is, in the United States at least, is for the most part a recreational activity. We can make behavioral decisions around that, and we could actually make instant differences in our area.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Jesse King.
And that about does it for this week's show. The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. We had help from the New York Public News Network. You can listen anytime at wamcpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. Look for program number 2527 and join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Giustina. Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.